two from her daughter, and her husband has grandchildren and a great-grandchild from his first marriage, a job at JCPenney, and a healthy commute, she enjoyed her life plenty before she got on board the Trump train. DeVos reaches back in her memory bank to discuss food and family cooking again, and her descriptions really make you hungry. My mother just made pork chops and stuffing and dumplings, but my dad, oh, my dad, he used to make these pancakes. I think they are really crepes that he made, because I remember they were thin pancakes and light and fluffy, but back then you wanted to fit in, so I think we just called them pancakes. She goes on to create an image of a delicate dough, almost like lace, artfully rolled on a plate. They were wonderful, with orange peel gently grated on the top. Somewhere, she says, her brother has her father's recipes preserved from the Belmont Hotel. She'll have to make them sometime. One gets the feeling her family dinners will be just as filling, even if politics gets taken off the menu. Chapter 4. Rough Rebounders. Unconventional candidates attract voters for unconventional reasons. And the way Americans choose between presidential candidates is as emotional as any consumer behavior. The old axiom among political pros is the beer test. Which of two candidates would most voters prefer to share a beer with? The consensus answer to that question rarely loses on election day. In 2016, one group uniquely attracted to Donald Trump, regardless of their politics, was voters who had experienced a setback in life and saw the same kind of vulnerability and recovery in Trump as they had experienced. A billionaire who regularly bragged about working back from debt and broken real estate deals, Trump was also a twice-divorced playboy whose personal life was far from unimpeachable. Unlike the perfectly coiffed family portrait groomed from childhood to be President Mitt Romney, or the image-conscious, guarded, lifetime political calculator Hillary Clinton, Trump was perfectly imperfect to a wide swath of the electorate. For all his braggadocio, he was vulnerable in a way neither Romney nor Clinton could be. His coarseness and profanity on the campaign trail reinforced his authenticity to them and made him a candidate worth walking through the fire of media ridicule to support. With every fact check done by the media on his outlandish, technically false boasts, typical of a condo salesman, he ironically proved he was exactly what they were looking for, the opposite of the stereotypical politician. To this group, the Americans who had overcome adversity and imperfection in their own lives, Trump's appeal was inextricable from his foibles, be it bankruptcies or family ruptures or tragic mistakes. Even in the primary season, focus groups found that this type of voter, the rough rebounder, was the earliest and often most enthusiastic adopter of Trump. The Great Revolt survey reveals that the rough rebounders in the Great Lakes states are decidedly more secular than the rest of the Trump coalition. Only 24% self-report weekly church attendance, compared to nearly 40% of overall Trump voters in those states. Barely more than half of this group call themselves conservative, compared to almost two-thirds of Trump voters overall. One in three rough rebounders are not Republicans, and fully 30% say they voted for Obama in either 2008 or 2012. Correspondingly, they put more trust in Trump to do the right thing for the country than other Trump voters do, relative to their trust in business, the media, or congressional Republicans and Democrats. A full two-thirds of rough rebounders rank their trust in Trump ahead of those other institutions, and an additional 16% rank him second. Rough rebounders were the most forgiving of Trump's lewd comments to Access Hollywood host Billy Bush, the only archetypal group of Trump voters surveyed in which fewer than 4 in 10 were offended by his comments. Given the fact that so many have experienced economic tragedy in their lives, it's no surprise that rough rebounders have the highest level of anti-corporate sentiment among Trump voters, with 85% saying corporations do not care if their decisions hurt working people. When Republicans lose elections, donors and media pundits routinely admonish party leaders that they must become less ideologically rigid and less conservative to win. It's unlikely that the rough rebounders, a more pragmatic group than the normal GOP base, is the bloc those critics had in mind to broaden the Republican coalition into a winning one in 2016. But with Donald Trump at the top of the ticket, that's exactly what happened. A less glamorous target than elite upscale social moderates, hip millennials, or racial minorities, rough rebounders nonetheless helped add votes to the GOP coalition that neither John McCain nor Mitt Romney got. And Trump's ability to keep them active and supporting his legislative allies will help shape Republican prospects in the 2018 midterms. Cindy Hutchins, Baldwin, Lake County, Michigan. Take one step inside Cindy Hutchins' variety store on Michigan Avenue, and you know that if you want it, it's here, somewhere, if you can find it. Northern Treasures is a throwback to the old five-and-dime department stores that once flooded America's main streets and cities, with wide aisles, lunch counters, hardwood floors, and stock that included sewing items, soaps, canned goods, fishing gear, gadgets, and wooden yo-yos. While there is no lunch counter in Northern Treasures, there is pretty much everything else. Outside, the sign welcoming shoppers reads, Northern Treasures, a variety store, and a whole lot more. Not only is the sign not false advertising, this scrappy little store in a town of 1,500 serves as a portrait of Hutchins herself. Compact, punching back against the odds, and achieving the American dream, $1 at a time. Hutchins' approach to retail is a complete rejection of the overflowing, fluorescent-lit multitude of bargain-dollar emporiums that now serve as anchors in strip malls across the country. Dollar Tree, Dollar General, Family Dollar, and the Dollar Store are places where the shopping adventure goes to die, with seasonal items in the front to lure you in, no-name brands, cleaning products and plastic items made from China and India flooding the shelves in back. Northern Treasures is like a walk into your grandmother's pantry and attic simultaneously. There are cubbies filled with colorful balls of yarn, antiques on sturdy bookcases sold by consignment, bolts of calico fabric, T-shirts celebrating the town's biggest event of the year, the Blessing of the Bikes motorcycle rally, canned goods, locally made crafts, fishing gear, sewing kits, spinners, makeup, and purses. So many purses. That is how this whole thing started, says Hutchins of her purses, then gesturing toward the entire contents of the variety store, which is larger than your average chain dollar store. I was always one of those people that was an entrepreneur-y type of a person. I started out selling purses after my husband went and got hurt in an accident. I thought, I gotta do something. I can't just sit here, she says. Hutchins' husband, Norm, went to one of the local flea markets and opened a booth selling a variety of things when he could no longer work construction after getting hit by a beer truck. For a while, things were tough for her family. That didn't work out because the overhead was too much. In the meantime, I set up somewhere selling my own thing, she says of selling the item every woman needs to carry all of her stuff, and wants because they are either stylish or practical, purses. I worked in a hospital, I'd set up in the break room after my shift, and I'd sell $1,000 of purses in 3 or 4 hours. I'd start doing different spots round the hospital. I'd just set up and sell. It helped pay the bills, she says. Cindy and Norm began coming up to bucolic Lake County, Michigan, from their home in Elkhart, Indiana, years before her husband's accident, camping and fishing up here so often that they eventually bought a small home. After Norm got hurt, she soon started dragging her purse inventory up to Baldwin, 85 miles north of Grand Rapids. We'd set up down at the corner there, she says, pointing to an empty lot, kitty corner, from their present store. The owner would rent us the lot for a holiday weekend, and we would clean up. We thought we wanted to live up here because of the situation down there in Elkhart and the circumstances. My husband didn't know if he'd be able to work again in construction, and we thought, well, let's move up here. The house is paid for, she says of their second home. Every day, Cindy and Norm grow out of the shadow of a life-altering tragic event, thanks to a new start in a new place. They see themselves as underdogs who are beating the odds the system gave them. And in 2016, Cindy Hutchins found an unlikely presidential candidate who was the biggest political underdog in recent memory, a billionaire who loved to tell a story about how he bounced back from being nearly $1 billion in debt in the early 1990s. I was walking down Fifth Avenue with a very beautiful woman, and I said, "Isn't that amazing? Right now, that man is richer than I am." And his beautiful woman said, "What do you mean? He's not richer than you." I said, "Yeah, he's worth $900 million more." I said, "Right now, that man is richer than me." She said, "Why?" "Because let's assume he's worth nothing, but I'm worth minus $900 million. Donald Trump, Washington Post interview. One of the unique archetypes in the Trump coalition in 2016 was a group of voters who did not come to him via a shared political affinity, but from an unlikely connection of perspective. The rough rebounders saw in Trump not only someone who had beaten the odds, but someone who might give a damn about other people trying to beat the odds and shake up the political system as he went. Rough rebounders could be found in the front rows of every one of Trump's signature packed house arena rallies. They were his enthusiastic defenders in even the roughest days of his up and down primary and general election campaigns. Unfazed by his scandals, galvanized by the knowledge that it seemed the political establishment and the press were adversarial to him, they projected their own uphill climb onto his. Whether they were bouncing back from foreclosure, bankruptcy, multiple family breakups, or business calamity, rough rebounders saw in Trump something they wanted to believe about themselves, a resilient and unconventional survivor who seemed tougher than his critics and his obstacles. Trump's missteps and gaffes and penchant for saying the impolitic, the inappropriate, or just the inaccurate, endeared him even more to many of these voters. Where journalists and political elites in both parties saw someone unready or uninformed, they saw someone winning in an arena totally foreign to the rest of his career. In that, rough rebounders saw another parallel to their own lives, making things work in an unlikely and unexpected new phase of life where the rules aren't always easy to follow. Politics might have been the last place to expect Donald Trump to succeed, and Lake County might be the last place you'd expect for a rebound like Hutchins's. With 11,539 residents, according to the last census, tiny Lake County is known primarily for three things: an abundance of pristine lakes and rivers, superb all-terrain vehicle trails, and the fact that you are never legally required to stop at a red light. Why? Because there aren't any. Literally, there is not one traffic light in this entire northern Michigan county. Baldwin, where Hutchins' shop, Northern Treasures, is located, is the largest town in the county, but it isn't even a town in the legal sense. It's a village, and also the county seat. It has to be. There are no larger populated places in Lake County. Baldwin relies on tourism of the active variety, fishing, canoeing, hunting, and camping, which attract city dwellers in the summer and fall. The foot traffic from locals and some snow sports help keep the lights on at Hutchins' store in the winter, as well as in the two bars located on Michigan Street. Life in Lake County is for the hardy. It will never be easy. There will never be an abundance of jobs. But the pace is good, and so are its people. It is also known for deep economic deficiencies. A study done by 24/7 Wall Street shows that the county's poverty rate of 30.5%, coupled with an 11% unemployment rate, makes Lake the poorest county in the state. The results also show that a typical household in Lake County earns $20,000 less than the typical household in any other county in Michigan. Just east of Baldwin is a small town called Idlewild, once one of the few resorts in the country where blacks vacationed in high style and owned property. When racial discrimination became illegal in 1964, it faded in popularity and eventually slipped into oblivion. The county has endured a complicated relationship with its largest employer, the North Lake Correctional Facility, for a decade. State budget cuts closed the facility in 2005. It briefly reopened in 2011, then closed again until June 2015, when inmates arrived from Vermont. In 2017, the privately owned and operated facility, which has housed only inmates from outside the state during its roller coaster existence, again faced uncertainty when it closed again, costing a community of 1,500 more than 100 full-time jobs. Lake County's voters are traditional blue-collar Democrats, and the jobs that matched their skills and work ethic were once abundant here. But that has not been the case for a very long time. Still, Lake County stuck with the Democrats. In presidential elections, it gave local majorities to Barack Obama, John Kerry, Al Gore, Bill Clinton, Michael Dukakis, Walter Mondale, Jimmy Carter, Hubert Humphrey, and Lyndon Johnson. It even voted for landslide loser George McGovern, one of fewer than 200 U.S. counties to do so. For U.S. Senate, Lake County has voted for only one Republican nominee in more than half a century, and that was only by 41 votes in 1994, the same year the GOP routed the Democrats. During election night television coverage, Lake was consistently a blue Democratic dot surrounded by a sea of rural Republican red in northern Michigan. Obama won this county by over 12 percentage points in 2008 and by 5 points in 2012. Then the dam broke. In 2016, Donald Trump pummeled Hillary Clinton in Lake County by a whopping 23 percentage point gap, the fourth widest swing from Democrat to Republican among Michigan's 83 counties. Hutchins is one of those voters who broke the dam, voting for Obama twice, only to flip to Trump. The petite brunette with sun-streaked hair is fiercely determined and independent. 20 years ago, before political correctness had taken over our vocabulary, Hutchins would have been called a firecracker. Ironically, she has no self-awareness of her unflappable persona, maybe because for her, life has never been easy. Hutchins was born in Marcellus, a village along the Michigan-Indiana border, with work the only constant. Grew up on a farm. Dad worked in a factory. Mom worked part-time, sometimes in some restaurants, she rattles off. I worked cleaning houses and in the high school cafeteria to help so I could pay for my school clothes. She calls her upbringing blue-collar, middle-class, and staunchly Democrat. My dad was a union factory worker. At the dinner table, politics was always discussed. Back in the day, the Democrats represented the working people. They actually represented them and their interests. Her voice trails off. Yeah, well, that's just a thing of the past. A customer comes in looking for a certain kind of thread. Hutchins is out, but gives her cell phone number to the woman to call when she knows she is heading back to the store. And if I don't pick up, just leave a message. Sometimes when I am on call doing home care, there is no cell service, she tells her. Home care nursing is her other job. Lake County is the kind of place where people who get by do it with more than one occupation. Democrats were the voice of the people, and they protected the working class, Hutchins says, as the customer, turning to leave, chimes in, even though no one asked. Yep, and that's the way it was. A lot of older people don't realize that's not the same anymore, she says. Straight out of high school, Hutchins registered as a Democrat and joined the Army. I was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina, then Fort Hood, Texas, she says, explaining that she left the Army with an honorable discharge soon after she got married and moved to Elkhart, Indiana. I just did waitressing jobs, and then I saw the economy in the country collapse right in my backyard. Elkhart, Indiana is the recreational vehicle and manufactured housing capital of the world. It essentially sets the tone for a lot of the economic climate in the country because of the RV industry. RVs, a luxury product consumed almost exclusively by the middle class, sell well when those customers are comfortable with their economic prospects, and the market dips when they are uneasy. It was the 1990s, and the recreational vehicle and factory housing bubble had just exploded, she says. And while she did not work in the industry directly, her bottom line was impacted along with that of the factory workers. I was a waitress at Bob Evans, and I remember it. I started making maybe $7 a day in tips, and I usually made at least $100 a day in tips. I'd owe the babysitter $6, which wasn't much back then, and I thought, I have to do something different. Her first marriage ended in the downturn, leaving her a single mom with two sons. With nowhere to go but up and out, she headed to the local welfare office and took a test to see how her skills could match up with available careers or classes. I think I finished the test in half the time and only got one question wrong, so they said, whatever you want to do, you can pretty much do. So, with the help of some grants, because I was a veteran, I went to school to be a registered nurse. After graduation, she started working in long-term care, remarried, and moved north to Lake County after her husband's accident. Somebody in a beer company truck slid into his van and messed him all up so he couldn't work, Hutchins explains. We had wage replacement from the insurance company, but after a while, they sent him to a doctor, and the doctor said there was nothing wrong with him, which was totally not correct, she says. I could no longer pay our mortgage, and the mortgage company won't work with me. 10 years, never been late, never missed a day. And the mortgage company was like, if you send us $10,000. I said, yeah, at the end of the day, you can kiss my ass, is what I say, she says laughing. She essentially handed the mortgage company the keys to her home and moved the family to their modest Lake County weekend home. Eventually, her husband was able to go back to work. Her two sons made it out on their own, and she found a job doing home care. Her union member father's affiliation with the Democratic Party rubbed off. Her first vote for president was for Walter Mondale in 1984, and she stuck with the party through the next 7 presidential elections, with particular enthusiasm for Barack Obama. Obama had this incredible presence. It was just like, wow, fresh. And he seems like a good Christian man, and he has values, and his family seems not all scandalous and all that. Yeah, I did. I voted for him twice. I thought, well, the first year, he's just getting his feet wet. Or first term, getting his feet wet. He didn't do a whole lot of harm, she explains. But midway through Obama's second term, Hutchins was tired of his policies and tired of the Democratic Party she had spent an entire lifetime supporting. The second term, I think it was almost like he just did whatever, whenever. I don't know that it was by his own doing, or that he was influenced that way, that he should do that, or coerced or anything like that. He was actually to the point of, I think, dangerous as a president to our country. He ran our country into the ground. It was very much a part of who I was and part of my identity. It was not an easy break to make. But now that I have made it, there is no going back, she says. Towards the middle of the second Obama term, I was like, oh my God, the end of this can't come soon enough. He keeps doing damage. He keeps doing irreparable damage to our country, financially. Financially, we were just out of control, and everybody started expecting everything can be free. Free cell phones, free college, free health care. It was just like people were just excited about anything they got free. The entitlement was crazy. One lady that worked for me at the store, who gets some government assistance, said to me during the election, "If Trump wins, I'll lose all my free stuff." That was exactly her thoughts. That's why they all liked Bernie Sanders, because he said everything could be free. Well, everything can't be free. And that's what these young kids were thinking that are all in college that voted for him. Give them free stuff and a hug. We cannot sustain ourselves as a country with nothing but hugs and handouts. And that was what my party became. It is ridiculous. It pains me to say this. It really does. But my party used to value hard work. Used to value climbing up the ladder. Now everyone wants to just sit at the bottom of the ladder and expect someone else to climb it for them, and then hand over the prize. Hutchins had for years resisted even the notion of voting for Republicans. I used to think that the Republican Party stood for country club folks in nice suburban homes who talked about bottom lines and stock prices. Not anymore. They are for the blue-collar worker. They are for me. And the irony is not lost on me. Hutchins knew the moment Donald Trump came down the escalator at Trump Tower in 2015, that he was her candidate. I knew because I knew he was a businessman, and I knew as a businessman that I liked his ideas. I liked his honesty. I liked the way he didn't take crap from anybody, and he didn't let anybody run his opinion, she says. I knew it was only going to get worse. I knew if Hillary Clinton got elected, oh my God, socialism. I don't know if we'd be able to sit here right now if Hillary got elected and speak, she explains. Obamacare was certainly one of the tipping points of her fracture with Obama, the Democrats, and Clinton. Her monthly health insurance costs are more than 50% higher than they were before Obamacare. And my deductible went from $1,000 to $2,500 a year. You know, one of the things I really don't get about the Democratic Party or the news media is the lack of respect they give to people who work hard all of their lives to get themselves out of the hole. It is as though they want to punish us for the very things we hold dear. Hard work, no dependence on the government, no debt, and so on, she says. Don't even get me started on how they feel about gun ownership. I was raised in a home with guns. A card-carrying Union Democrat home with guns. And yet someone says there is something wrong with me for being comfortable around a gun or using one. A lot of people probably think, oh, you're a woman with a gun. You're probably a bitch. That's probably what they think. It doesn't make you a bad person. It makes you a protected person. I got my concealed pistol license when we first moved up here. I had a .22 and a long gun, she says. A bad experience in her store led her to that decision. We had somebody walk in our store and walk out with merchandise, which I would never shoot anybody for that. I would just call the police, which is what I did, she says. It's the backstory about that person that changed her. When they took him to court, the shoplifter claimed on the witness stand to have multiple personalities and that he hadn't taken his medicine for a month. Describing the robbery, she says, at first, I confronted the person, but then I just backed off because I could tell with my nursing background something wasn't right there. And I thought, you know what? I'm just going to call the police and they can handle it. And they did. They caught them and they were prosecuted. But it was just like I thought. You never know when this could go a different direction. I need to be protected. Plus, I'm out here and I'm by myself at home sometimes. Where I live is very isolated. I've had a van pull up one time and this young kid comes toward my door with a roll of paper towels in his hand. Before he got too close, I came to the door and said, first of all, I just need to let you know that I do have a gun and you need to leave my property. I had it holstered. He left. I walked back inside the house and went to check out the back door and the van had driven back there. She called the police. This is why I need protection, and I have the right to that protection. Today, she has four guns. They are all pink in some way. One's dipped in Muddy Girl camo, my little .22 that I carry. The other one, I just got at Christmas, is a 9mm. I got a Taurus 380 and a .38 Special. A .38 Special's a revolver. Hutchins's independent streak extends beyond her desire for physical self-protection. I don't charge anything. I have no credit cards. If I can't pay for it, I am not buying it, she says of her personal spending habits. A lot of people don't understand what the 2016 election was about. It really wasn't about Trump. I mean, not really. It's about this town and this county and this state and this country. And that is all very hard for the news media to boil down because it does not make sense to them and their worlds, she says. Another customer walks in looking for fidget spinners, the latest widget toy for distracted kids, and Hutchins points her toward a basketful, to the young mother's delight. Hutchins again gives out her cell number in case the mom is looking for something different next time. You can't get that kind of service at the dollar store, says the woman. Heck, you can't get that kind of service from your doctor, Hutchins says, but you can from a nurse. She beams about her other full-time job. That election was about this store. Everyone in this country has some version of this store, something they achieved either by accident or determination or both. And we had been missing that for years. We kind of didn't know we were missing it, but we all finally pulled together and did it. But because it is larger than Trump, at least I think so, that thread between all of these various types and kinds of people has begun to stitch together. Yes, we were angry, but we were and are hopeful, aspiring for a better life, a better town, a better country. David Millett, Erie County, Pennsylvania. David Millett tucks his half-eaten sandwich back into the black-and-white checkered parchment paper inside the basket in front of him. He stands, carefully wipes his hands and face, steps away from the picnic table, and begins to sing. On a warm summer's evening, on a train bound for nowhere, I met up with a gambler. His raspy baritone voice croaks and croons, pitch perfect. His snow-white hair, a little on the longish side, enhanced with a neatly trimmed goatee and sparkling blue eyes, could convince you that you're listening to Kenny Rogers freestyle singing without a band in the parking lot of the Ugly Tuna Tavern on Peninsula Drive on Erie's west side. For an instant, you are convinced you are looking right at him. Except, of course, you are not. Nonetheless, a handful of young people walking into the popular bar cheer him on and coax him for more. He obliges. He can't help himself. Then he smiles shyly and sits down to finish his dinner. At 68, Millet has seen it all, and then some. But for now, on Tuesdays and Thursdays, he does Kenny Rogers impersonations. Years ago, when I was working in Connecticut, karaoke first came out. That was like 1990. I was with a bunch of managers at dinner to kind of get to know everybody. You know what I mean, kind of a deal? This is who this person is, that one runs that department, that kind of stuff. We're sitting at a restaurant, and we got out of work late, because we're managers. We don't get out of work on time, we get out late. It was like 7 before we started eating, 9 by the time we're done. Just bullshitting there. This guy sets up this machine there. He brings books around. Nobody else is in the place. Millet recalls asking him what he was doing. The guy explained it's like the old days of the bouncing ball. You just follow the words on the screen and you sing along. As the department heads were getting to know each other, one of them says, "Well, I'd do it, but I gotta have somebody sing with me." "Shit, I'll sing with you," I told him, and I got up and I sang with him. I was in love. It was so much fun. Wow. Since then, Millet has also cultivated an uncanny physical resemblance to Kenny Rogers. He has won contests and done the impersonator circuit at small clubs and casinos around the Great Lakes cities and towns. I never bought tapes. CDs weren't out yet, but my daughter had Kenny Rogers' greatest hits in the car. I had an 8-hour trip every weekend back one way from my job in Connecticut to my home in Erie. 8 hours. To keep myself awake, I'd listen to that Kenny Rogers tape, and that's how I got good. Millet was born and raised in Wesleyville, a working-class Erie County town and suburb of the city of Erie. The township literally sits in the shadow of the massive General Electric locomotive plant to its north. U.S. Route 20, the longest U.S. route in the country, spanning 3,365 miles coast to coast, runs straight through the middle of town. Downtown Erie is only a few miles away, across more than a few sets of railroad tracks. Over Millet's adult lifetime, Erie County has fought to just hold its own. Just over halfway between New York and Chicago, and situated on a Great Lake, a major highway, and trunk railroad lines, Erie boomed in the period following World War II, adding 100,000 people to reach a population of 275,572 by 1980. It's hardly ever been larger since. Now aging and in economic transition, Erie's trying to rebound itself, a situation that runs in David Millet's family. When he was young, Millet's father managed a car dealership. And then eventually that dealership closed. So he got into insurance. He was into insurance for a long time, became a claims supervisor. Then my brother got out of the Navy and wanted to start a body shop. And that was where my dad's heart was. So they opened a body shop, he says. It is the job from which his father eventually retired. After high school, Millet served an apprenticeship to be a tool and die maker. During my apprenticeship, You had to take at least 2 nights a week for classes. I went 4. I took engineering instead because I figured I might as well do something with, you know, my time and my abilities. So I got an associate's degree in engineering. I got into management later. I was a unique kind of a guy, where I understood the whole mechanics of tools and the process. I got to learn the process at a place that I worked, so I became valuable that way, he says. Despite his tenacity, he has never worked at the same place for a very long time. The longest I worked anywhere was 8 years, but 5 years, you know, 6 years here and there. I moved around a little. I got a job in Connecticut for a year and just stuff like that. I managed Tetra Tool over here in Erie, then EMSCO Plastics. And then he got sick. Very sick. I was 49 years old, and I couldn't even write my name. My body was just done for 6 years like that. I couldn't even get off the couch, he says. Everything on his body hurt. Nothing worked. Even his eyelashes hurt. For a long time, no one could figure out what was wrong. Chronic fatigue syndrome is what they called it, but I found out what it really was. It was a yeast infection. It's called Epstein-Barr Candida albicans yeast, and I stumbled onto it later, he says. While he was sick, his wife Evelyn, Evie, was stricken with cancer. My wife passed away. She got cancer. I couldn't work. Things really were bad, you know? Tears fill his eyes. His ruddy complexion flushes red, and he stares off for a very long time. He struggles to maintain his composure. Millets is a very masculine presence. It is clear that he takes pride in his role as a man in control, but for the moment, he is not. I could take her pain pills. I finally got the doctor to prescribe them for me. I said, hey, I'm just telling you, with the Vicodin, I can do something for, like, 4 hours. I can't do it any other way. He needed a couple of hours a day of pain relief so he could care for his dying wife. I had to take care of her, so I did, he says. She died in 2002, at the age of 50. A couple of years later, he met a woman who had teenage children. I was helping her kids with the internet because I build computers for a hobby. They didn't have internet access. Nowadays, it's like you got it on your phone, but back then it was different, he explains. Millet eventually connected the old computer to the internet, and the kid was able to use it to do research for the project. It was a biology report on different funguses and how they impact the human body. The research revealed what Epstein-Barr Candida albicans yeast is and what it does to your body. I started reading down through it, and I was like, that's me. Oh, shit, he says. So that was it. I changed my diet, and in 3 months, I was like a new man again. I lost my career out of the whole thing, but I've started back bartending with my friend. She worked down here at the Clifton Manor, 1 night, 2 nights. They were only open 3 nights. Did that. Then a guy one night comes in, and after we talk for a while, he offers me a job at FedEx, and I am back in the game. Politically, Millet has never been a Democrat, but he's also not exactly the most loyal, card-carrying Republican. I was attracted to the Republican Party at a young age. Let me rephrase that. I was attracted to the ideas and values the Republican Party is supposed to stand for. A respect and admiration of the Constitution, and the virtue in working for a living, he says. I'm very skeptical of organizations, though, including the establishment part of the Republican Party. So in that way, I am not one of those ideologues. Millet is skeptical about Republicans, but he's not skeptical about Donald Trump, a take-charge guy after Millet's own heart, and someone with the black-and-white approach a rough rebounder can rally behind. My dad always worked. He worked two jobs. We had seven kids, so he was a smart man. Smart, smart man. He did body work on the weekends to supplement working for an insurance company as an adjuster. He built his own house, you know what I mean? At the beginning of the 2016 primary season, Millett liked the outsiders, such as Ben Carson and Trump and Ted Cruz, because of how Cruz was always sticking it to the establishment in Washington. I never liked Jeb Bush. Not even the least little bit did I like Jeb Bush. Chris Christie, nope. John Kasich turned me right off at the end there when he tried that crap political stuff, manipulating stuff with his delegate argument for a brokered convention. Oh man, that just froze him for me, he says. In the past, Millett has voted for candidates he didn't particularly like, such as George W. Bush. You gotta vote for one or the other. That's what America's about. We got only a couple parties worth voting for. I didn't want to throw my vote away. This whole swamp shit that's down there is so corrupt on both sides that I felt he was the lesser of the two corrupts. He was for pro-life. When it gets down to it, I gotta go pro-life. I can't monkey around killing babies, okay? Can't do it. If you have that choice, I gotta go that way. George Bush never impressed me. Never impressed me. I wasn't fond of his dad. Okay with him, but not fond. Not like, God, I want to follow this guy anywhere, he says of Bush Sr. Ronald Reagan, on the other hand, was Millett's hero. I've got every time he was ever on TV on VHS. He explains of the old analog videotape recordings popular from the 1980s until the turn of this century. I got racks and racks of tapes of everything he ever did. Millett started taping him because he could not believe what he was hearing. This guy's not going to do this stuff. None of them do. They can say anything they want to get in office. What they do after they're in office generally doesn't match up. They get swayed. Whatever, whatever. I was interested in holding his feet to the fire, just like I am Trump. He says of another man that has really impressed him. I just love the guy. I mean, I have to say, I just love him. Millett isn't the only person in Erie with an outsized affinity for Reagan and Trump. The latter's plurality victory in Erie County, with 48% of the vote, was the highest total for a Republican here since Reagan's 51% in 1984. And the only other time a Republican has carried the county since Richard Nixon did it in 1972. As I got to listen a little closer and realize the gist of what Trump was saying, what would you say as a non-politician? You'd say, let's bomb the bastards, right? It's not like he's going to, but he says it to let people know he means business, Millett explains. The press takes him too literally, he says, echoing a refrain that became popular during the campaign by those trying to explain Trump's appeal. Trump has to rely on the people he picks to be good at their jobs. If they aren't, he will find a not-too-subtle way to get rid of them, Millett says. When I managed Tetra Tool, my boss relied on me. When a customer called in and asked for something, he would say to me, Dave, when's that mold going to be done? I'd say Thursday at 2. If I was wrong more than once, I would be in a different position real quick. I had to have my shit together because he relied on me. He was running the big show. He relied on me to run the whole shop and to be into the nitty-gritty of what was going on. So, I can understand Trump totally being that way, he says of Comey's firing and Trump's displeasure with Attorney General Jeff Sessions. You know, being a tool maker, you don't know what you're going to make tomorrow. It could be making a case that looks like this, with those cutouts like that. Could be that glass. It could be that cup. It could be the front of that, he says, pointing to a garden boundary stake. You don't know. They throw this at you. What are you going to tell them? Well, yeah, I am going to tell them I can do it. You're going to do it. you're going to figure out a way to do it. And you have a certain logic that you follow, and you say, okay, 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 okay. There's nothing that stops, no doors, you know what I mean? At that point, you got to have a can-do attitude, and that's what Trump has, Millett says. He becomes animated, explaining the Trump way. I just love his moves with North Korea. When to hold him, when to fold him. He's like, okay, I can go toe-to-toe with this young punk with a little-ass country like that. I'm big America. I can go toe-to-toe with him. I gotta show him a little lesson first. Okay, China, come on over here. You and I haven't gotten along. We haven't dealt with this. You don't like to buy our products. Whatever the reason, let's talk about it. But I'm going to tell you, you're in missile range of North Korea. We're not yet, okay? They don't like you, just saying. We'll help protect you. We're going to do that. We're somewhat trading partners, but it's for your benefit. He told everybody on the news, that son of a bitch, they're taking advantage of us. It's a true statement. But you don't talk to him face-to-face that way either, Millett says, talking a mile a minute now. He knows what you said. He knows coming into that meeting what you think about him. Now you say, okay, here's the deal. You've been buying that coal from them. We got to put a hurting on them. We don't want to bomb them. They're crazy. But we're crazier. We'll bomb them back. Their missiles ain't even going to get off the ground, and we're going to knock them out. If need be, but we don't want to go that route. Cut their money off first. Now, you need coal. We have coal. All you got to do is loosen up that trading so that it's a little more fair. And we're going to make sure that, with that money we make, we'll put missiles. We'll line the whole 38th parallel with missiles, if you want, to help protect you. 'Cause it protects us, it protects them. It's a win-win, Millett says, finally stopping to breathe. Millett admired Trump when he met with the Premier of China. Their system is completely different than ours. I've worked with a lot of guys that have a completely different system of building a mold, building whatever, dealing with life. You find common ground, you get along. Doesn't mean you like him, just means you're not going to fight with him. He says. His son, one of five children he had with his late wife Evie, worked at the General Electric plant in the background. He just got laid off from GE, so I know a little bit about GE. General Electric recently opened a new high-tech plant in Fort Worth, Texas, that Millett, and many locals interviewed in the spring of 2017, believes will eventually upend the plant in their city. They're chasing the ball out of here. Drive down the street and see. All the regulations and all of the new technology chased everybody out, he says. Their concerns would prove not off base. In late July 2017, GE Transportation announced plans to end most locomotive production at the 100-year-old plant, eliminating nearly 600 jobs. The work done in Erie will now be done in Fort Worth, Texas, beginning in late 2018. The last bastion of Erie's massive mid-century industrial base, GE Transportation had only recently lost its long-held status as the county's largest employer to the local hospital branch of the University of Pittsburgh's medical arm. In a graying city, the job of attending to the retired locomotive makers is becoming more lucrative than being a working one. Millett's son, like his father, is remaking himself and trying to rebound. Going to college right now, 42 years old, going to college. His son also loves Trump. Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. He, my son, is very much like me in that what gives you satisfaction in this life is the work, not the handout. Not any of that stuff. Work. Not to get rich. That's why I'm still working at 68. I just love working. I want to have a job where I feel like I'm doing something. I only work part-time, so it's like I get the best of both worlds, he says. Millett is not a fan of anything big. Big banks, big media, big corporations, I want nothing to do with them. For him, it is personal. When I worked at EMSCO, we made our own products, snowboards, you name it. We made a lot of products. Walmart handled a lot of those products. EMSCO liked to get into Walmart because, of course, you got 9,000 stores and whatever, whatever. It makes sense, right? Okay, here's what they did. We, EMSCO, came out with some lawn edging. He says of the common pound-in landscape edging found on lawns across America. Walmart was like, whoa, we'll take 50,000 of them. That's a lot of edges, boxes of them, 100 to a box. Walmart says, we'll see how they go, Millett explains. Well, they sold like hotcakes. EMSCO got about $12 to $13 per 100. Next year, Walmart orders 250,000 of them. We ended up having to build 11 molds altogether to produce like this. Hired people, got machinery. We're banging these things out, he explains. Millett says, in the third year, Walmart tells the company, we weighed them. There's only an ounce of material in each one of those. We figure the cycle time on this should be 30 seconds. You should be able to make this many in a day for your machine. We're going to give you $8 a hundred. Wait a minute. It's our product. It's our product, and you're telling us how much? Now that we got 11 molds based on what you projected for the following year, and you are essentially cutting our price nearly in half? They went to China, had them built, knocked us off totally. As a consumer, they're good for you, says Millett. As a business thing in this country, they weren't so good. That is essentially the core of why I don't like big businesses or big political parties. It's kind of why I love Trump. He's not part of the ideological crowd. He is part of the let's do something crowd. Despite losing 6 years of his life to Epstein-Barr, Millett keeps going. You can't give up. You reinvent yourself. You make bank. You find a way. You fall down. You get back up. I've lost plenty of jobs, and I've earned plenty of jobs, he says. Millett says he will absolutely vote for Trump again. Well, here again, like Reagan, I'm going to keep his feet to the fire. Long as he's trying, as long as he makes sure he has our back, well, then he has my support. Renee Dibble, Ashtabula, Ashtabula County, Ohio. Renee Dibble has 11 children, 15 chickens, several roosters, a couple of rabbits, a goat, several ducks, 3 dogs, 4 kittens, and a lovely, modest home in Ashtabula, Ohio. The cows and the pigs are in the freezer, she jokes, as she slowly makes her way through the kitchen into the living room. The menagerie of animals is outside on this brisk spring day without a cloud in the sky. Her home is immaculate and charming, with a steep ceiling and rustic fireplace enhancing the living room. 3 separate photos of young men in marine dress blues are at the center of the mantel. Those are my Oreo cookie, she says of her 3 sons, 2 black, 1 white, all 3 smiling broadly. The daughter of workhorse small business owning parents, Dibble has been a waitress, a caterer, a school bus driver, and a lifelong Democrat in a lifelong Democratic town that has seen better days. She has soft, wavy blonde hair that just reaches her clavicle, and her eyes are blue. She is built sturdily, but is struggling slightly. She is recovering from breast cancer. She is in remission, but has had some recovery complications. She's on the rebound, and like a lot of people on the rebound, her tenacity has made her both pragmatic and impatient with politics, factors that drove her vote in 2016. Outside the home, her husband is mowing the lawn. He is a detective with the City of Ashtabula's police force. She first laid eyes on him when he was a beat cop at a traffic stop. At the time, both were divorced. She had two children. He had three.